So in the Kabir poem, he says, just throw away all thoughts of imaginary things not yet come, and stand firm in that which you are. Stand firm in that which you are. That last sentence, stand firm in that which you are. Well, some of you will think, that means emptiness, or does that mean selflessness, or does that mean the infinite? Well, if that's where you are, that's what it means. But if you're not there, that's not what it means. And I really, that, I could stop talking. That would be the end of the talk, really. Because what I was seeing in the forest refuge was that I was giving talks that were hopefully encouraging a stretching for people so that they were having to consider something beyond what they have taken themselves to be. And I like to do that because it keeps us the journey honest. It keeps us from sort of contracting around the only assumption we know about ourselves, and that's me and mine and that sort of thing. And so we just keep Dharma open and expressive so that it moves beyond just that particular self-centeredness, then we stay honest. But that doesn't mean that the people were supposed to start living that reality prior to the realization of it. And I saw some people attempt to do that, and to their own despair, because they weren't able to do that, it worked against them. And I thought there were enough people there, and I thought, oh, you know, I have to, this is a fundamental. Remember, we're on fundamentals of Dharma. And we have looked at a number of fundamental issues. We've looked at bare attention as a fundamental issue of what Dharma is. We've looked at samadhi as a training to stabilize our attention so that we even know the difference between the thought which obscures that bare attention and the bare attention which holds the thought. And we talked about moving into the difficult as a translation for not being aversive in our life and just going towards the pleasant, but as a real tract and direction for ourselves to move into those areas that seem so repulsive or discordant in ourselves or difficult, and that there is truth that lies in there. There's really the gold of our own insight that can penetrate that difficulty. And then we also looked at the basic denial of the basic fact of denial, which we refuse to see something that's right in front of our eyes just because we don't want it to be part of our reality. That goes on a lot in smaller ways than just climate change. Please save your emails. Every time I mention climate change, I get a bunch of emails and little things dropped off saying, you don't understand, climate change isn't as bad as you think it is. I would suggest you re-looking at that issue, for those of you who would like to. Oh, sorry. We're having a technical problem. All right, okay. So let me know if it goes off again. Maybe somebody could get me the backup mic here. So this sense of denial of essentially saying that reality isn't configured in the way I want it to be, so I'll just forget that the way it is and assume that it's different and pretend and imagine and direct my energy towards the reality I want to show up as opposed to the one that is. And that, of course, is the definition of suffering, and that is, of course, the definition of what is difficult for us to face is our own denial of the reality that's at hand, and that's the reason that we suffer. So all of those together are forming fundamental issues for ourselves that we need to move very deeply into. I I mean, forest refuge, to get into the forest refuge, you have to have done a number of retreats. So it's often a very experienced practitioner who comes to the forest refuge. But I found that there were, many of them were missing the fundamentals of what we've been talking about here. Not missing them so much as just never having really immersed themselves in those. And then they play out the sense of escapism, going, bathing themselves in the pleasant features of a long samadhied retreat, and never realizing that they're just replicating their daily life in a more accentuated form by finding what's pleasant in their retreats and nourishing their life on that, rather than seeing what is really the difficult expressions that are in front of them. So these are not small Dharma points. These are major foundations on which we build our Dharma practice. And I really want to encourage people to take whatever one of these points resonates deeply with you and to keep yourself on that point until you really sense a deepening within it. And so the one tonight, Hamlet said it best, I think it was Hamlet, "To thine own self be true," wasn't that Hamlet? Somebody. Polonius to his son. I should have known. Staying within yourself. So what does that mean, you see? You hear a Dharma talk about emptiness and cosmology and all of that, and yet we feel the burdens of our own despair, our own depression, our own sense of longing or unworthiness, our own abandonment issues, or our multiple reactive ways that we are. And we think, okay, so I think I'll be empty. That seems like a better reality than the difficult of my own self-discouragement. So I'll just go there. And we can start framing the references of what we see in our Dharma issue in disguised format so that it appears to be empty and appears to be less of a problem than our psyche might be saying to us. It's because we want to bypass ourselves. We want to get over ourselves. We want to go to some other self, even if it's an empty one, that doesn't hold the catastrophe of what we have seen or the past pressures of our life. And so we do so. We do so. And we move away from ourselves. But Kabir says, stand firm in that which you are. He doesn't define what you are. Whatever you are, stand firm in it. Stand firm in it. And it's only through that stability and willingness to discover the location where we think we are. We don't form a certainty around where we think we are or where we appear to be. There's no certainty there. We don't start establishing a narrative about this as being the end point. We just acknowledge where our understanding resides and we work with that difficulty, the difficulty that comes through that understanding. And then we'll find that that understanding will grow on its own, will evolve and expand on its own if we keep ourselves honest and move into the difficult without denying what we see. We'll find that the whole of the Dharma rests within that stability of standing firm and questioning what's in front of us, ourselves. There is one young man on retreat. He was going to be there the whole month, and he was just having a terrible time. I mean, his face was all distorted, and he was pressuring himself, and he would go into periods of despair. And on interviews, I said, you know, what's going on with you? Oh, he said, you know, he was just trying to actualize what I was saying. I said, don't try to actualize what I say. Actualize what you are, where you find yourself. Don't move from there.
Mind
So if I could have that other mic, I would. Hello? 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 Yeah, okay, there we go. To thine own self be true. I don't know where I was. Oh, yes, the young man. So I said to him, you really look like you're just having a horrible time. And together we decided that it probably wasn't the right time for him to be doing that intensive kind of retreating, and that it wasn't the best location for him, and that maybe it would be better for us to end the retreat early, and to make sure that he wasn't going to take that as some sense of failure. And he and I spoke together, and we finally decided that that was the best thing for him. As soon as he made that decision, his face lifted. There wasn't the tension in it, and he was just buoyant. And I said, wait a minute here. What just happened? What has changed? And he says, I'm off retreat. And I said to him, that's what I wanted to see on retreat from you. The buoyancy. That's where this whole thing is pointing. What is the heaviness, you see? Hopefully the point was made for him. But that's the point is that when you go back to the basic continuum of the Buddha, and let us never forget this, because this is the working map for wherever we find ourselves. From suffering, the continuum, to the end of suffering. Now, if we are outside of our understanding, if we are trying to work this thing conceptually rather than really knowing what it is that we are seeing, we're going to find ourselves in greater despair. We're going to find ourselves in tension as we try to gain something that seems to be available but does not seem to be available to us. Other people speak about it or talk about it, or you hear it about it in talks, but just doesn't resonate as true to our own practice. And so we'll put in a lot of effort and tension to try to get ourselves to that place that we think the journey is moving toward. And that's going to create suffering. That's going to create tension. Bells should go off at that point. This is about ending suffering, not creating suffering to end suffering. And I ask you whether the practice that each of you do has that contraction, that sense of personal pain and turmoil and despair of wanting to be somewhere else other than where you find your life, where you find your Dharma, and whether that's an addition to the suffering piled on that's already in your life. There's no need for that. This is a very pragmatic practice. This is down in the earth dirty, right? This isn't skyward. This isn't ethereal, like, Ouija boards kind of stuff. This is like plowing the earth with your horses. And from that sense of really getting our fingernails dirty and looking at what is in front of us, we can begin to pull out of this thing. It begins to move for us. It never moves when we are thinking ourselves ahead of where we are. Never. It only feels discouraging. So when and if I give Dharma talks that are not locating you, that are beyond what your understanding is, you should take it as a shooting star. Right? You're out in the field and you see a shooting star and you go, ah! Like that. Like a moment of wonder. A moment of curiosity. A moment of something showing you the enormousness of the universe. And then the shooting star is gone. You have to come back into your peasant clothes and you have to plow the field. Okay? So that's how this thing works. The shooting star was an important inspiration. It was an important aspect of wonder. It gave us a sense of the mystery, which ignites a certain fuels us in a direction that is very helpful. But we don't live wishing for shooting stars. We plow the field in front of us. We do what's necessary for us to move the next foot ahead of ourselves. And that means we face the difficult situations, the tensions within us, the anxiety we have, the issues of reactivity and abandonment and unworthiness and all the other ones that we carry with us. And we explore those and we firm ourselves up. We establish a sense of perspective in ourselves and a sense of stability. Now in the East, they understand this. In the West, we go right to the meditation. Okay, we just want the samadhi, we want to feel better, we want to alleviate the tensions in ourselves. We don't want to have to mess around with things like ethical conduct and generosity, which is where in the East, Buddhist traditions that have been alive for hundreds and hundreds of years, thousands of years in some case, where they base their practice, they start the practice, where they teach the young, is there. First, generosity. Why generosity? Just follow this and you'll see immediately what it does. I always thought, oh, those things are just for, you know, to be good. Okay, let's move to the meditation. That's where the action is. That's right? No. When you play with generosity, when you move, when we will have a whole talk on this and Sila, because I'm really, as you can tell, I see the need here. But in generosity, first of all, you learn the spirit of sharing. If you didn't learn it in kindergarten, you learn it here. The sense of a non-self-centered approach to life, where you're allowing other possibilities to come in, and rather than just everything being about me. But even more important than that, you're also learning the no of generosity. Not just the yes. The yes is important. The yes takes us out of just thinking about ourselves. But if you don't think about yourself, you're going to deplete yourself, right? And for those of us who are romantic caregivers, that is, you don't consider yourself within your caregiving message, then you deplete yourself. And so you establish a no in generosity, which is not something this culture has learned very much about, because we think a no is selfish. No, a no is a part of the very expression of generosity. If you didn't, you would have nothing, and the world would be no better off than the way it is now. You realize that? You could give away every dime you have, and it would be no better off at all. And so you say yes, yes, no. That's it. I can't do it. And it establishes, you get formed in saying that no. There becomes an uprightness. You get unified. You become solid in yourself, you see? You know yourself. You know the edge. No, I can't do that. Sorry, I would like to, but I just can't. I can't afford it. I don't have the capacity. I don't have the energy to do that. I say, no, I can't. I have to set my own limits. That's allowing us to own ourselves, to stay within ourselves. That no is just as important as the yes. And somehow we think that no is being, we romanticize it. It shouldn't have any no's, right? If you really had generosity together, you just keep giving. Nonsense. That's where we don't believe in ourselves sufficiently to even notice the disadvantage that our generosity is doing, what our generosity is doing to us in terms of our own disadvantage. And this is why when we come to the pillow, we can't stay within our own limitations. We don't even, because we don't know what those limitations are. We don't know the no of an ideology, of a philosophy. We can't say, no, that's not where I am. I'm here. A wonderful talk, Rodney. I didn't understand a word. I'm right here. Right? Or sila, ethical conduct. Another extraordinarily important place. Tinder. Because in sila, we start out, don't we? Most of us, because we haven't practiced it. It's not a very honest culture. And so it's kind of foreign to us. And so we start out very moralistic because that's what we have learned to be. That's what the preachers seem to be saying. You know, do good. So it's a very moralistic, and that creates a self-righteous tightness in us. And that is quickly seen as not being helpful because it's really an increase of suffering. So then we become idealistic in our sila, in our ethical conduct. Like, gosh, I don't want to kill one small thing, so maybe I should not take a step or move out. Or we start idealizing everything. I had a hospice nurse say, I have to quit my job. I said, why do you have to quit your job? You're doing a wonderful job. She says, no, the gasoline I'm burning is creating more fossil fuels in the air. I said, well, what about the patient who needs you to burn those fossil fuels, who's dying at the other end of that journey? There are no perfect solutions to these things. Everything's a compromise. Everything's a compromise. Living life, you're going to be transgressing as well as progressing. That's just the fact of living. And so if we get too idealistic in our ethical conduct, you find yourself unable to move. I can't take antibiotics. I don't want to kill the bacteria. That's how absurd it sometimes gets. You see? And you box yourself in because you don't know your own yes and you don't know your own no. We don't get the feeling for what's available to us here. What's the flexibility? What's the movement? What's the room I can move within here? I feel boxed in everywhere. You see? Now you begin to understand how important it is staying within yourself, especially when you start hearing the Dharma, and we haven't learned those lessons because the culture hasn't taught us the lessons of generosity and the lessons of sila, of morality, of ethical conduct. We just get lost, you know, thinking, oh, because we're driven. We don't have a sense of self-knowledge, enough self-information to know what the patterns are that's driving us. How important it is to know what the patterns are that are driving our behavior. If it's unworthiness, we should at least know it. We may not be able to stop the momentum of this unworthiness, but we should at least get a sense of how those patterns play through our day, right? So that we try to compensate by being perfect in what we do, or we try to compensate by being outside of what we know we can do and to give a presentation of us looking better than we really are. All of those different ways are going to come into Dharma practice. You sit down, those things are going to show up. And if you don't know about them, they're going to show up very apparently. And they're going to interfere with us taking a seat of assurance, of confidence, of stability, and being sound in ourselves. I don't know what's going on. I don't know all that stuff. I have a sense that it was a shooting star. Great. Now I'm back here being miserable and selfish. Let me look at it. And every time I my effort is always self-serving, and I'm tense within my effort because why? I want to be somewhere where I'm not already. I'm trying to get out. I just feel compelled to get away from me. Let's just be honest with it. You see, it starts the stability of form, the stability of what holds you in your body, a full embodied presence starts with that honesty. Here I am. Pressured on all sides, my past coming through me like a locomotive out of control, trying hard, trying to be perfect, feeling afraid, all of that. That's the difficult. Doesn't look like smiles. Doesn't look like the perfect angel. And we have this image in mind that it should be all, you know, sympathetic joy and wonderful Brahma-viharas. Nonsense. It looks like plowing a field. And so until we get a sense of that, until we get a sense of, okay, you know, we can do this thing, we just have to be willing to get down in our blue-collar uniforms and just dig in here. That takes incredible humility to be able to see that. Do you feel the humility to be able to realize that the journey is not going to go faster than your ability to be honest? This is a journey of attunement, not of destination. You see? The more we attune ourselves to ourselves, the more we move along on the path, because we're listening to ourselves in more subtle ways, that very sensitivity to self moves us forward. When we think of it as a journey to somewhere, we're bypassing that very attunement. We're trying to skip over things to get the journey going faster, to get to where we think we need to be. This is a journey of attunement. And there's no better way to attune to oneself than being present within oneself and knowing exactly what the form and shape of that self is taking in this moment and being honest with it. There is no path of arrival here. There's just a path of deeper listening and attunement. That's all. Now I want to talk about three levels in which this compulsion to listen outside of herself comes from, because it works in three different locations. And the first one is outward authority. When we feel inside and we're not honest with what we feel inside, which is a sense of dependency, where we don't feel like we have it, we feel like other people do, we feel like we're shaky and unformed in there somehow. We feel like this is beyond our comprehension and beyond our ability to comprehend. And so then we concede at some point to give our power away and look for someone in form, some teacher, somebody, who represents our idealism as to where this practice is going. And then we just give over or let go of our own empowerment to know where we are and let that person, that external person, guide us. The worst possible mistake you can make. Nobody knows where you should be. Nobody knows where you are. Not really. Nobody knows what the next thing for you to do is, except yourself. There is no teacher that has that ability to be so fine-tuned with you that they know exactly the next step you need to take. But they'll say they will, and that'll just convince you, because we don't feel our own fiber of strength to say, no, that's wrong. This doesn't fit for me. I'm not going that way. That's crazy. I'm not doing that. Well, just, oh yeah, it doesn't. Then you do it and you go, oh, it doesn't feel right, but he knows better or she knows better. We stay within ourselves here. And any teacher that tries to tell you that, walk away. No, run away. Or the sense, this is the one that, because we have such a deep eroding sense of self inside, such a deep sense of self pain inside, we don't think this is possible for us. So at least I'll hook myself to somebody who saw that or has perceived to be that it is possible in them. And I'll stay close to it. Maybe it'll rub off. It doesn't rub off. It just gets you more frustrated and despairing over time. And it is possible for you. For every one of you, it's possible. Not only possible, but close. Very close. The greatest obstacle is your belief that that's not true. That's your greatest obstacle. Is that long ago you gave away that possibility, and you're willing to compromise for a little bit of sand work, a little bit of sandblasting here and there. Touch-ups. At least I'm getting something out of it, right? I feel kinder. Well, that is something. But is that enough? The possibilities here are endless. That's the first level. Then there's the second level, and that is the opinions and the commentator and the narrative within ourself, which jars us into shape. We are literally believing the tale of our worst nightmares when we believe our own sense of inward story, our own sense of inward narrative. I can prove I'm this way, we say to ourselves, because if you knew the history I had, or the parents I had, you'd see why I could never, ... And because I've lived within these patterns of powerlessness, reactivity and anger, I know I can't do it. So what does that leave me with? Well, I'll tell you what, at least you don't know yourself sufficiently if you stop there. To know yourself sufficiently knows that all of that has to be dealt with, can't be avoided. But we don't arrest ourselves there. As long as you don't arrest yourself there, it will not freeze you into that description. Just keep marching it forward. Deal with what's ever in front of you, what's ever is closest to you, that's what you deal with. And if the pattern arises, you deal with the pattern. You just keep walking it. But you don't walk away from it, you walk through it. So it never defines you, it never fixes you, it never creates the definition of you. It's just that all of us have the voices inside telling us exactly what we have known ourselves to be. All of us in the room. And when we're quiet enough to hear them as voices, then we're strong enough to walk through them rather than to believe in them. And so we just do it. And it's hard. I don't mean that this is I don't want to oversimplify it in the sense that to make it Pollyannish, but that's why we form as a Sangha. Because together we give each other the strength and courage, because we hear the sincerity across the room, we hear somebody speak from honesty, and that ignites our own. And we go, wow, why can't I do that? And that contagious quality of integrity and honesty and just simply looking, that provides the whole context for the movement through ourselves. What do we think self-knowledge means? I perhaps want this for you more than you want it yourself. So there's a third. There's the now that we have sensed where we give ourselves away in dependency to others, and where we feel dependent upon our own narrative for our own sense of self-description, there's a more subtle voice there. There's something quiet. I think it's the Quakers, they call it the still small voice within. Or maybe it's the Sufis. Somebody. Once we have dealt with the external dependency and the internal dominance, once we have dealt with that, we can't hear it until we've dealt with that. Because we keep, those voices get all locked up in some kind of cacophony of sound. Sounds like just a bunch of crickets in there. You get a sense of what's right for you. This is the most important voice you'll ever hear. Because it is your path. It is our path. When we know that this is right, and somebody next to us is doing something else, when you have an inward sense of self-deficiency, you'll think, oh, I should be doing what they're doing. No, you should be doing what you're doing, if it feels right. And you should not be doing what they're doing if it doesn't. So there's no one way to do it. And that's so freeing. For some people, being a monk or a nun is the perfect life, religious, spiritual life. For others, children at home, full on, interactive, is the perfect spiritual life. If that person, living in the throes of the full Monty of life, looks over at the nun, who's her friend, and says, oh, you know, if I had it together, zero. You are dead in the water. If that nun looks over to her friend, who has children, and think, oh, God, if I had only, dead in the water. It has nothing to do with the form our spiritual journey is taking. And the same form used by two different people, it can work for one and not work for another. And the only way we know, because a teacher, they just teach. They just say, okay, well, we're all going to sit for half an hour. All right. They don't know. Is you. You see this level of sensitivity of ear it takes here? It's like we're doing this by braille now. Nothing's written. There's nothing in the... Give me the sutta reference for doing that. Nothing. We only have our heart. We only have our heart's beat. We get a sense, okay, so this is this teacher's working for me or this teacher isn't. And when the teacher works for a while and then all of a sudden he or she's not, then I leave. I go somewhere else. And I know that, and even though there are 500 people with that particular teacher and I'm the only one leaving, I leave. That's what it takes. Now there you go. Now you're getting a sense of why this is a fundamental within the practice. This is so essential. And when I saw it, I thought, "Oh, I've got to talk to Sims. I've got to talk to them. I've got to share this." Because I thought it was a given. I thought everyone. This is like okay. This is like, you know, day one, right? It's not day one. None of these fundamentals are day one. And there's such richness in them. They just keep moving us forward. You could take one fundamental and you could move it completely right on through. Staying within ourselves. Feel the stability, if you just for a moment, feel the stability of what that means to you. And stand firm in that which you are, says Kabir. Feel the courage it takes. The alignment. Know yourself. Thank you. Maybe we could sit for a minute or two. And as we sit, find your plumb line. In one experiment, in a college experiment, one of these psychological, unbeknownst to the people who were doing the study, the people on the opposite wall were not hooked up to the shocks that the subjects thought they were creating for the people on the other side of the wall. So when they were instructed that when the person on the other side of the wall made a mistake, answered something wrong, they were to give them ever-increasing shocks, that the experimenter was encouraging them to give more and more severely as the mistakes accumulated. So you had this subject, and you could hear the screams on the other side of the wall as they were administering these shocks that actually weren't being administered to them, but they had no way of knowing that. So they had some college professor bearing down on the student, saying, "Go ahead, give them some more, give them some more, give them some more," to the point where there was a red part of the scale that said lethal. And with the encouragement of the professor, they were willing to give the lethal dose for missing the question in that experiment. Know your plumb line. Know yourself. And by God, take your hands off the shock machine. I'm not doing it. I don't care what you say. Enough. Okay, so if there are any questions or comments. Yes. What would I say about what I'm saying in terms of the individual, in terms of couples? Well, you know, a couple is itself a kind of an individual, isn't it? Right? Have you noticed that? That the reason that some of the old forms were that you blew out the two candles and lit the one, well, you're really establishing a different entity. An entity of commonality. That you would allow your boundaries to cross and merge to form that intimacy. And so it's a different arrangement, it's a different sense of moving forward when you're with another person as a couple. But there are basic ethical standards that even a couple can't take away from us. There are basic senses of our own history that we always, no matter whether we're coupled or in a group or wherever we might find ourselves, we're responsible for. Our own reactive patterns, our own history, our own sense of dependency, and often what happens within a couple is that those get blurred. You don't see why you're acting the way you're acting towards that other couple because those very patterns are playing themselves out rather than being understood. And so the first opportunity within a couple is to understand the very patterns that we're playing forth within that relationship, to know our part in things. So it's never a complete merging of identities. It's also two separate people who are playing forth their histories within that relationship that need to know those histories very firmly and very thoroughly. Yes.
I noticed on the homework you were talking about, I think you said something about doubt. Is that correct?
I don't really remember.
I think there's something in there about doubt, no self-doubt.
Yes.
So I find myself experiencing doubt.
Yes.
And so when you said stand firm and, you know, in yourself.
Yes. Right.
How, and I think Einstein said, you know, the mind that created a problem cannot solve.
Okay, I sort of get this. So let's just, okay. So tell me if I'm wrong, but you're saying that how do I know that firmness and integrity when all around me is doubt, when the only thing I'm hearing inside of me is the doubt about what I'm doing, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it could be like either or like, yeah.
No, let's just go with doubt. Okay, let's just stay very simple here. You see, anytime there's any voice within you that is some sense of insufficiency, mistrust it. Mistrust it. It was given to you long ago. It's a sense of an entunement that you were given. Your parents or whoever was around you, or you just picked it up somehow, in which you assumed a sense of being less than. And that's where doubt comes from. When you don't feel less than, you don't feel self-doubting. Mistrust those voices, because it simply isn't true for anyone that they are less than anyone else ever. So that's what I mean being firm, staying within the knowledge that what these patterns are not the truth in me. And these are the ones I'm working with and working through. I'm not going to stay within the truth of something that's false for everyone and consider my doubt to be real. I'm going to question the doubting. And I'm going to question it from a stability and understanding of the principles of Dharma that says there is equality all around. Now let me look at this one. So I take it on. I don't deny it. I don't try to bypass it. I don't try to move around it. I don't pretend it's not there. I say, let me look and feel the pain of my own doubting. And then there's stability in being able to challenge the framework that has, up until this point, established our foundation. And now we begin to question that stability of doubt, that sense of doubt. Everywhere I go, I just doubt. It's a good one because most of us have it. And we need to move forward right into it. We need to go right through that one. It's not easy. It's very difficult. But why would we believe it? To believe that would be to believe all the messages we received when we were very young and didn't have the conscious capability of sorting through those messages to see what's relevant and what isn't. Any sense of self-deprecation, self-defeat, it's all intoned. It's not true. There isn't just one winner in the human race. Everyone's a winner. We just have to claim ourselves as such. If there was only one winner, then there would be 7 billion minus one truly doubting people, truly unworthy people. And one person somewhere would be the one person who won. It's ridiculous to think that way, isn't it? Yes. 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 Yes, that's right. So she said about my, I talked about being in Braille. It's a very vulnerable place to be in Braille, isn't it? So there is some vulnerability you can't get over in this, because whenever we fix ourselves as a particular position, you have to question that fixation, because there is no position that's truly representative of you. So you have to, but you don't bypass any of them. And so if you feel doubting, you go, okay, let me look at this, let me feel this. What's the wise way to work with that? And so then all the practices that work for you but may not work for anyone else, you start doing. Even practices and their appropriate, using the appropriate practice or technique or method, that's again an attunement of the heart. Well, everybody's doing metta. It doesn't feel right for me. Well, maybe it doesn't feel right because you're so, I don't know. There's a sense, not just that it feels good. I'm not talking about feeling good. The feeling right is very different than feeling good or feeling bad. Or, you know, for a while I did metta. I did it for a number of weeks, and it felt awful. It didn't feel like I believed it. I'd feel like it was just, I thought, well, this is a good sign. I knew in myself it's a good sign, because I'm kicking up a lot of dirt with this message of self-appreciation. Now, anytime I'm kicking up dirt because I want to like myself, there's something wrong, right? In the rebellious mode of not allowing myself to be likable. So all of us have that sense, don't we? It says, okay, so I'm not just going to go to what's pleasant, I'm going to go to what I need to do. And that's following that still small voice in us in terms of a direction. Okay, that's all for tonight. I want to encourage people to use the homework, and then we'll come back next week in discussion groups.